I was at River Bend for 11 years and thoroughly enjoyed that, but I think I was a missionary to the Baptist, trying to show them the way of the Presbyterian faith. Now, this is the book you see up here is a copy of my 13th book. I've written 15. I just published one this past week on prayer, the title of which is Why Pray. And it's available now on Amazon. But I want to talk about Cotton Eye Joe and why I wrote Cotton Eye Joe. Almost 60 years ago, it's hard to believe, I was a freshman in college. And I came from a blue-collar high school where I paid very little attention in class. I laughed a lot and had a good time, but I was not what you call a stellar student. So I got to Austin College, which I don't know if you know about Austin College. It's a fine liberal arts school that attracts very good students, of which I was not one. But they let me in by God's grace. And I lasted 4 years and graduated right on schedule. That freshman year, I went to dinner late one evening. I don't even remember why, but I may have been in the lab or something, but I went to dinner late. And I got my little tray, and I went out to the dining room, and there were three students in the dining room. Now, my choice was I could go eat by myself or eat with those three students. So they were all seniors getting ready to graduate. I didn't know them, but I went and put my tray down and just sat there, said good evening to them like I had the right to be with these seniors. And they kind of looked at me with a skeptical eye, and I caught them in a discussion of the rightness or the wrongness of the Texas death penalty. Is it right to kill people, or is it wrong to kill people? What's the morality of that? And being a freshman who didn't know anything, I jumped right into that conversation. And I got crushed. I mean, I got crushed. They were all for the death penalty, and I said, well, God is the giver of life. And so, in my simple view, God is the one who takes life in the story, in full stop. And they told me how simplistic and stupid I was, and they got up and left me. I kind of crawled back to my dormitory, feeling about as low as a slug. But I made a commitment that night. I said, if I'm ever privileged to study theology, I will come up with a better argument why we shouldn't kill people. It's real simple to me. One of the Ten Commandments is, thou shalt not kill. And I know the just war theory of St. Augustine. Still, the commandment says, thou shalt not kill. And I have a hard time believing that Jesus himself was in favor of crucifixion. I have an impossible time believing that. But he went through it with grace and courage and forgave those who killed him. But that doesn't make it right. So the question upon us is, we the people of the state of Texas kill more people in capital punishment than any other state. So let's fast forward to 2018. I'm now a grandfather, and I've been an ordained minister at that point almost 50 years. In the Presbyterian Church. And I'm sitting on my front porch, not my front porch, but a front porch in Buena Vista, Colorado, with my 6-year-old grandson, Henry. Henry and I are eating cinnamon rolls. He's sipping milk and I'm sipping good coffee. And I'm looking at these magnificent peaks before me and just pondering the beauty of God's creation and the beauty of those mountains and of the sky behind them and of the beauty of Henry sitting there looking at me. And all of a sudden, a story popped into my head. And I started thinking about this story. And it captured my heart. It captured my soul. When I came back to Austin, I got on my computer and I decided I would write a book about a black man in East Texas who is convicted wrongly of murder. And today I'm going to tell you that story. And then I'm going to let you read the rest of it to get to the end. I'm not going to tell you the ending, so I won't ruin it for you. The subtitle, as you can see, is It's a Tale of Grace. I'm a big believer in grace. What is grace? Grace is God's love for us, God's forgiveness, and God's mercy all of the time, without question and without condition. It's just you're forgiven, you're accepted, you're loved. Theologian Paul Tillich talked about the acceptance of the acceptance. We have been accepted, but so many of us don't know that we've been accepted. We think we have to earn it. We have to go be super righteous. We have to go and do great things before God will love us. And that's just simply not true. God loves us as we are, forgives us as we are, accepts us. And our work is to accept the acceptance. That's all I've got to do. That's all you've got to do, is to accept God's acceptance, which is a core decision the soul makes, that I'm going to accept the acceptance of God. Now, in this novel, there are four major characters. There's a man named Will and his wife named Ruby. Those are the names of my grandparents. But these characters are nothing like my grandparents. My grandparents were tenant farmers, sharecroppers in Deep Piney Woods, East Texas. And my grandparents were desperately poor for the whole of their lives. Granddaddy got an eighth grade education. I wrote a book. After this book, I wrote another book about him. It's called Lessons I Learned in the Milking Pen. When I'd help him milk cows, he'd tell me his wisdom. And so I thought that deserved a book, and I wrote the book. Wisdom I Learned in the Milking Pen from this man named Will. The second character is his wife, Ruby. Will and Ruby Amos. Why did I name them Amos? Because Amos is my favorite prophet in the Old Testament. And one that I read all the way through in Hebrew once upon a time. And there are two other main characters. There's Joseph Berg. This man is Joseph Berg. You can see him up there. He has cataracts, and he's blind. He can't see. He's got some vision, but not enough to really get along in life. And he's black. And he lives in the little town of Grapeland, Texas, which is where my father grew up. It's a town of 1,800, not even big enough to be a county seat, in the oldest county in Texas. And he's a saint. He prays all of the time. He's illiterate, but he prays. And he knows enough to pray. And he goes to the barbershop every day, and he sweeps it out for free. He mows people's lawns for free. He helps women carry their groceries out of the grocery store, although he's not allowed into the grocery store. He has to stand at the door because he's black. They won't let him in. But he carries their groceries to their truck or their car, and he's the first one at his church every Sunday morning. And when the service is over, he sweeps and mops the floor, cleans the pews, and he prays. He has dedicated his life to prayer. He might be called a mystic, but the people in Grapeland, Texas call him Cotton Eye because he's got two cataracts, and you can't see his eyeballs, his pupils. And he is the hero in this story. He's the protagonist, and a man I fell in love with when I was writing the story. I just thought, this is the kind of man who changes people's lives, not by what he says, but by how he lives. He just lives a quiet, simple, peaceful life. The fourth character and the final major character is the Reverend Cassius Armstrong. Cassius Armstrong is a black preacher. He went to high school, and he got to go to a Bible institute for 1 year, but he never got to go to college or seminary. But he memorized Scripture. He knows Scripture backward, forward, inside out. And he is a faithful preacher. And he's a prophet in the little community of Grapeland. And what he teaches his people is, because we're black, you're going to be abused. You're going to be discounted. You're going to be disrespected. You're going to be marginalized, cast aside. But as a Christian, you turn the other cheek. You show no resentment. You never retaliate. You just simply turn the other cheek. And he's the pastor of the Church of God in Grapeland, Texas, an all-black congregation. Well, Armstrong grows up in Graceland, and he has a lot of talent. He's academically brilliant, and he's athletically gifted. And he, his junior year, he makes All-State as a quarterback. Now, you know small-town Texas. When you're an All-State quarterback in small-town Texas, you're a god. And A&M and UT are both after you all the time. The other schools can just forget it. But you're a god. And he decides right before his senior year he's not going to play football anymore. His coach literally cries on the day that he shares that information with him. He wants to study, and he wants to go to Yale University and study pre-law and become an attorney, go to Yale Law School or Harvard Law. And he can do that. He's got the academic ability to do that. So he quits football, and he studies, and he makes all A's and makes a perfect score on his standardized test, and he's admitted to Yale. And he's pre-law, and he's full of himself, and he's very arrogant and very satisfied that he has been chosen for greatness. He has been chosen to go to law school, go to Congress, and eventually become president of the United States. He knows God has chosen him for this path. And one night, he is invited, along with five other students, to have dinner with a guest speaker named Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. So he meets MLK, and MLK talks about humility being the bedrock of greatness. No person is great without genuine humility, being humble, and allowing God to be in charge of the life. And this changes Will. He's deeply moved by this conversation. He changes his mind, and he's not sure what he wants to do. His mother contracts breast cancer, and she dies way back in Texas. He's up in New Haven, and she's in Texas, and she's dying of cancer. He prays every day and every night for her to be delivered from this disease, but she dies. So he gives up on prayer. He said, prayer is nonsense. Nothing happens. You're just talking to yourself, or you're talking to an imaginary friend. Prayer is a useless enterprise. And he's bitter about God. He's bitter about this idea of humility. He's bitter about his mother's death. But he decides to return to Texas, and he's kind of lost. He doesn't know what he wants to do. And lo and behold, he decides he will go to a Presbyterian seminary because he wants to study. He wants to know about this fellow named Jesus that King was so high on. So he enrolls in my alma mater, Austin Presbyterian Theological Seminary. That was convenient for me, so I could relate my familiarity with that school with his experience. And he goes to the seminary, and he graduates with the highest honors, and churches come calling on him. They want him to be their pastor. But he has a question for every search committee. And he leans back in his chair, and he looks at those people, and he says, my question for you is this. Is your church a verb, or is it a noun? And if they say it's a noun, he's not interested. If they say it's a verb, he gets real interested. But nobody ever says they're a verb. They all say, well, I guess we're a noun. And so he chooses not to go into the ministry. His grandfather dies, and he inherits his grandfather's 160 acres outside of Brickland, Texas, in the country. And he decides to become a poor farmer. He's going to raise a few calves, some truck crops, watermelons, tomatoes, corn, etc., to sell in town, and live off the land. He returns to Austin, and he marries a young woman he's met there at the University of Texas. Her name is Ruby, and she is a PhD candidate in some field. I forget what I said it was, but she's a PhD candidate, and she's a potter. She loves to create pots out of clay. They get married, and they move back to Grapevine to the farm. And he has to decide where he wants to join a church. He goes to the various white churches in town, and they're all nouns. So he finds a church full of black people, pastored by Cassius Clay. Cassius Clay, Cassius Armstrong. And Cassius Armstrong is a prophet. And he likes the fact that he's teaching his people to be nonviolent and to be peaceful and to love in spite of all the abuse that you're going to suffer. So he becomes an active member in Cassius Armstrong's church, but he refuses to pray. And he befriends Joe Berg, the man on the cover of the book. He admires Joe. He realizes that Joe has no education, but Joe knows more about wisdom and truth probably than he does with his Yale education and his seminary education. Now, there are a couple of other, I mean, there are several characters because any novel's got a lot of twists of plots. Two more characters that you need to know about. One is Billy Frankston. Billy Frankston is one of the two town drunks in Grapevine. There are two. And Billy Frankston gets drunk every weekend and staggers around the town looking for his house. He finally finds it. He goes inside. And the other is a Deputy Grayson, who's a deputy of the Sheriff Department in Crockett, Texas, which is the county seat of Houston County. Billy Frankston is wandering around one night, lost. And Deputy Grayson comes up in the squad car, and he stops him because he knows he's drunk, and he wants to help him home. Frankston starts fighting with him because he's drunk. So Grayson takes his billy club and hits him on the head. And what he doesn't realize immediately is that he's killed him. He's murdered this man. And he can't have a career, and he can't live this life that he wants to live if he's convicted of murder. So he knows enough to know that Joe Berg will be coming along that very route in just an hour or so, because he does it every Friday night. Joe Berg goes to his cousin's house for a fish fry, and he follows his dog home. He can't see, but he follows his dog home down the very route where Billy Frankston is lying dead. So Deputy Grayson takes a pistol and he shoots Billy Frankston in the head and kills him. He's already dead, but he kills him. And he waits for poor Joe Berg to come down the road. And when Joe Berg gets there, he knocks Joe Berg out and he puts the pistol in his hand. He drives off, comes back, and pretends that he's just happened upon a brand new murder scene. And he arrests Joe Berg, Cotton-Eyed Joe. So Joe's put in jail, and he prays while he's in jail. That's all he does is he prays. He doesn't protest. He doesn't scream and yell and curse at the sheriff and the deputies. He just prays. Now, what I haven't told you is that Joe Berg has a lot of profound ideas that he has discovered in his prayer, but he can't write. He doesn't know how to write. So he goes to his pastor, Pastor Armstrong, and he tells him, I've got these ideas, Pastor, but I don't know how to put them down. So the pastor says, well, tell me your ideas. He shares his ideas, and the pastor writes them down, and they're profound. They are deep, deep into the soul ideas about our relationship with the holy, with all that is holy. And so the pastor writes them down, and the pastor thinks about it for a while and ponders it. And first of all, he says, this can't come from a human being like Joe. It comes from God. It came through Joe. So he makes it a book. And he takes the book to Dallas and gives it to a professor at an all-black college, Bishop College in Dallas. And the professor reads it. He gives it to a publisher, and it's published. And Joe Berg is the author. Pastor Armstrong gives him all the credit because they're his ideas, or God's ideas through him. And the book becomes a runaway bestseller in several languages all over the world, because it's so unique and so unheard of. This illiterate man having all of this profundity come through him and onto the written page. So he's in jail praying, and his friend Will knows that he's got to help him because no one else can help him. But how do you help him when you're a poor farmer? You have no money. You can't hire a lawyer. Anyway, he gets in his truck. He puts on his best overalls. In East Texas, they're called overhauls. He puts on his best denim overhauls. in a white shirt and a tie, and he drives to Houston because he's been told the best defense lawyer in the country is in Houston, Texas. And I had a little fun with this guy's name. His name is J.R. Outlaw. So J.R., of course, is not going to see him. He's too busy. But an associate sees him. And she hears the story of Cotton Eye Joe. And she says, well, Mr. Amos, I want to tell you, we'd love to help you, but it's $1,000 a billable hour to work with us. And with all due respect, you don't appear that you can afford that. He said, no, I can't. But I'll tell you what I'll do. I'll give this Mr. Outlaw my farm. I'll give him everything on the farm, all of my animals, everything, except my wife. I'll give him everything if he'll take this case. And so the associate visits with J.R. Outlaw separately, and he says, I've never met anybody who's willing to give everything to help a friend. I'd like to meet this man. So on a cold winter day, J.R. Outlaw and his grandson drive to Grapevine. They find the farm, and they meet Will Amos. And Will, he says, why do you want to do this? And Will says, for once in my life, I'd like to see the Sermon on the Mount come to life before my very eyes. I'd love to see this kind of righteousness in the world. J.R. says, well, I came out here to see your farm, but I don't want your farm. That's your farm. But what I will do is I'll take the case pro bono because I want to see the Sermon on the Mount come to life too. You and I share that vision. So at that point, Joe is thrilled. He's got an attorney. He's got the best attorney, he thinks, for Cotton Eye Joe. So Joe has this book, and Amos begins to read Joe's book for the first time. He can't believe it. He just can't believe what he's reading. It's so profound. It's so simple, and yet it's so revelatory of grace and of love and of the passion of God for us human beings. So as he reads the book, he decides that he's wrong about prayer. He's going to start trying to pray again. And he prays, and he goes out to his pasture every day, and he sits on the log, and he prays all day long. That's all he does. He listens for God, and he prays. Well, J.R. Outlaw wins a change of venue, and they move the trial from Crockett to Nacogdoches. Ruby, in the meantime, scrapes up $2,000 in a variety of ways, and she charters a bus, and the entire Church of God boards that bus, and they go to Nacogdoches to be in that courtroom to support their brother, Joe. And in the meantime, Will Amos feels himself slipping into a new consciousness. He's becoming a mystic. He's becoming someone who lives so close to God that he's having visions. And he thinks about seeing a doctor about it, but he thinks, nah, I think this is what's supposed to happen when you get as real as Cotton Eye Joe has gotten with God. And one night, a major thunderstorm, as they have in East Texas, comes up on his little farmhouse. And his wife is away. She's in a prayer vigil, all-night prayer vigil at the church for Cotton Eye Joe. But Will Amos goes out on his front porch in this storm, and he sees the lightning crashing, and three figures come up out of the driveway and walk toward the porch. They don't identify themselves. They worry him because he doesn't know who they are. And he goes inside and he gets a broomstick to protect himself. And these figures just look at him, but he can't see their faces. He can't see their eyes. He just sees the silhouette of three, probably men. And they bow slowly before him, and they give him one word. They don't use any words, but somehow, mysteriously, they give him one word, and the word is trust. So he's comforted. And he goes to Nacogdoches to the trial. And he knows that they're going to, he's brilliant as J.R. Outlaw is, he knows they're not going to win. Because Joe is black, and this is deep East Texas in the 1950s. Joe's not going to win, and he knows that. So sure enough, the jury returns the guilt of the verdict guilt, and they remand Cotton Eye Joe to the Polinsky unit over in Livingston, Texas, which is death row. And Will promises him that he will go to visit him every week for as long as he's there. And he goes to the Polinsky unit every week, and he prays with Cotton Eye Joe. They pray, and they visit. And he's amazed at how joyful Cotton Eye Joe. He's on death row, and he knows he's going to die. And he knows when he's going to die, but he's happy. He's not worried. He's full of joy. And Will just can't bear this. He knows the injustice in this. But still, he goes every week. Finally, the day comes for the execution. And when that day comes, Will gets to Huntsville early. Now, I've been to Huntsville, and I know how this thing operates. There's a cafe right across the street from the prison called the Texan Cafe. So Will goes into the Texan Cafe, and he sits down. And this big, burly, obnoxious man comes over and says, "I know you. I've seen you in the newspapers. Your name is Will Amos. And I'm a reporter for the Dallas News." So they sit down and have coffee together and talk. And this guy says, "I will show you how to get into the witness room at death row." So they leave the cafe and they head toward the prison. And they go into the witness room. And I'll stop right there and let you read the rest of the book. But I will give you a hint. I'll give you this hint. If you read the book of Acts carefully, you will find a story in the book of Acts where Peter is in prison. St. Peter is in prison, and he's in chains. And does anybody remember what happens? John, what happens?
Well, that all the jailers go to sleep or something, ignore them, and the gates open and they all come out.
That's right. Angels appear in the cell. The chains fall off and he escapes with angels. That's a hint. Now, my reviewer is a lifelong friend who is a former seminary president. I've known him since kindergarten. And we've seldom agreed on much of anything. But he did the review in the Outlook, and he said the ending was kind of magical thinking. Well, maybe so. But you have to ask yourself the question, do you believe Acts of the Apostles is a true story or not? And I do. I believe Peter actually escaped from prison. So if it could happen for Peter, why couldn't it happen for a black man God loved tremendously in East Texas? It makes sense to me. But I'll leave that to your own judgment. But that's Cotton Eye Joe. Are there any questions anybody has?
Do you know Charlie Shedd?
Yeah.
Did he fill in for you several times at the church?
I'm sorry?
Did he fill in for you several times at the church?
He was at Riverbend before I got there.
Okay.
And I sort of kind of replaced him.
Okay.
Gerald Mann didn't think it hurt to have another Presbyterian. So Charlie, I think, was retiring. And I got invited to go there, and I did. And it was the best decision I made. One of the best.
I'm curious, the book that they wrote that summarized everything Cotton Eye Joe had learned from prayer, can you tell us the name of that book? Is it in the...
It's just fictitious. It's just a fictitious book.
Okay.
Yes, ma'am.
How long did it take you to write this?
This book took me the better part of a year. I came home from Colorado in August, and it was published the last week of September of the following year. Nonfiction takes me 6 months. A novel takes me longer. A novel is a heavy lift. And I have the best editor in the world. I'd send her a chapter and she'd write back and say, you need to do da 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 da, and I'd do it, and it was much, much, much better. But the difference is she's bringing and I'm not. That was a simple difference. But I've just finished this last book I published this past week is my 15th book. And I told people I've written 500 newspaper columns and 15 books, and I think I probably said too much. I'm done. We got a little time. Y'all want to hear a funny story?
Yeah.
Has nothing to do with what I talked about. There was a man who wanted to be extremely supportive of his wife. He made that decision before they were married, that this woman deserves to be supported in every possible way. I will never criticize her. I will never judge her. I will never belittle her. I will only support her. And so he told her that, and she appreciated it. And one morning she said to him, you know, we have this gala coming up Saturday night, and I need a new dress. He said, well, go get what you need. Go get a gown. Go buy whatever you want to buy. And it's fine with me. The price doesn't matter. Just get what you want. And she said, well, take your cell phone to work and keep it on your desk. I need to talk to you later today. He said, okay. So he goes to work, puts his cell phone where he can see it, and he's doing his work. And he gets a text from his wife with a photograph. The photograph is of her in a gown she's trying on from the back. And the text at the bottom of the page says, does this dress make my backside look too big? And he wrote in there, N-O-O, exclamation mark, no. But before he could send it, the spell check changed it to M. So it spelled move. Yeah, you can't go home after you've done that. Well, I'm ending early. Is that okay?
Oh, that's fine.
Yes.
That's fine.
Yes.
So, with respect to the death penalty, you know, I've read a number of books and also understand the data which suggests or proves that it's inequally applied, et cetera. So, I'm wondering from a theological standpoint, I understand what you're saying about, you know, the thou shalt not kill. But do you have any other theological bases for that argument?
I do.
I'm kind of interested in how one might make that argument.
I do. After 50 years of doing this work, 25 of being a certified pastoral counselor, I've come to the conclusion, and it wasn't a difficult conclusion, that the best way to define human beings is to say that we are mistake makers. There's not anybody on this planet who hadn't made mistakes. All of us do. And that's why we have God's grace. Because we're not perfect, and because death is final, I cannot, in good conscience, say that I can trust human beings to make a decision that is so final. Because we're going to make mistakes. And consistently, you read about people who have been exonerated, who are on death row because a jury made a mistake. And I don't want that on me. I don't want to say whether somebody can live or die. I don't have that right. I don't have the authority. All authority comes from God. As the book of Job says, and I love this book because I've used it in every memorial service or funeral. When Job lost everything, he said, the Lord has given and the Lord has taken away. Blessed be the name of the Lord. Only the Lord can take away. I can't. I don't have any authority. I'm a feet of clay, mistake-making human being who stands in prodigious and constant need of grace. So, I just don't have the authority theologically or any other way to do that. I don't care if there are 11 of us, or 12 of us in a room, 11 and me. I just don't think we have that right to authority. Because it's just the law. And who creates the law? We do. We make up the law. and there are good laws, and throughout my life I have encountered laws that are not good laws. I learned how to read when I was 5 years old, and the first word I learned how to read was the word white, because our family was poor and we had one car, and my parents put me on a bus to go to kindergarten. And the bus driver knew where I went to kindergarten at the church. So he would drive right up next to the church and let me off. Same bus driver every morning. But my father got on the bus. The first time I got on, he said, "Son, that word is white, and that's where you sit. You don't sit where it says colored." Now, to me, I didn't know that when I was five. But the time I became conscious and grew into awareness, I realized that's wrong. That's a bad law. Apartheid, it was the American apartheid or segregation, were bad laws. My church in Dallas, my beloved church where I was raised, and I was affirmed, and I was supported far more than I deserved, did not allow black members until I was a senior in high school. And I was kind of like Will Amos in college. I kind of gave up on the church until I went to work in a federal program for Lyndon Johnson's War on Poverty. And I realized that the federal government is not going to bring in the kingdom of God. If it's going to be brought in, it's going to be brought in by the body of Christ, by the church. So I went back to seminary. I went to seminary after a year of graduate school. I went to a graduate school in an all-black university. And that was an interesting experience. I have one half of a master's degree from Prairie View A&M. But I didn't finish it because I felt called to go to Austin Seminary, and I went there and did that master's degree. And that was the right decision for me. But I learned a lot, and one thing I learned is that though it's a law in the book, doesn't mean it's moral or it's right or it's of God. So I probably started preaching. I better quit. Thank you all for having me.
Thank you. Before you leave, one quick thing. For the next 3 weeks, just to give you an idea of what's going on in class, Chris Knapp's going to be returning, and he's going to be teaching on the 12. This is the 12 minor prophets at the end of our Old Testament. So that's what's coming up. But I definitely want to thank Bob for coming. This is, like I said, this is the fourth or the fifth time he's coming. It's been really great.
Thank you.
And I can't believe that you're not going to write another book.
No, I'm done.
We don't believe that.
Well, you can trust me on that. I'm done.
So Bob is your wife, also a retired librarian?
Yeah. She
and
was the associate
she
dean.
Is she writing books?
She has written some books, but she's not writing now.
Okay.
She's being a grandma. She was associate dean of the information school, which you and I would call the library school at the University of Texas.
Yeah.
And she's retired. But she is, yes, a librarian. The house is very organized.
So we don't go on after that guy.
I don't know, that's a tough question. I had to fix it.
what you said. The kingdom of God is not only a ship by the government.
No, that's certainly not.
Charlie Shedd, my wife and I met him.